Hey, folks, and welcome to Movie Crush. It's Chuck Bryant here, and I am in New York City, actually. So I'm not recording at our lovely home base at Pond City Market in Atlanta, but I am on tour with Stuff You Should Know, doing shows at the Bell House in Brooklyn. And so while I was here, I thought, well, I should really try and take advantage of the celebrity of New York and get someone in here in our partner studio here at CDM Studios. And Mr. AJ Jacobs acquiesced. He's a pal. He's an email pal and a lunch in New York pal. He reached out just a couple of years ago as a Stuff You Should Know listener, and just a super nice guy. AJ is a book author, and boy, how should I describe his books? He's one of those guys that kind of goes deep in his own life in order to write a book about what he's doing. So, for instance, his great book, The Year of Living Biblically, he lived according to the Bible for a full year, as strictly as possible, which included everything from like wearing white all the time to growing his beard out to ridiculous lengths, which I know his family sort of enjoyed. And he's just a great guy. So hit AJ up in his favorite movie. Well, actually, his first pick was Groundhog Day, but that had been used by Griffin McElroy. So he had a solid backup plan with A Clockwork Orange, the watershed monumental Stanley Kubrick classic. And we had a really great conversation here in New York about A Clockwork Orange. It was pretty exciting for me. So here we go with AJ Jacobs and A Clockwork Orange. Are you native New Yorker?
I am.
Okay, I thought so. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up right here on the Upper East Side. And there was a video store two blocks away.
Oh, really?
And it was a good one. It was not, it was like, they had a serious selection, and I went every day and watched a movie after school every day during high school.
So okay, starting in high school?
Yeah. So I had – and the pretentious ones, too. They had a lot of, like, you know, foreign – they had, like, the petite charm of the bourgeoisie or whatever it was called.
So you got into good movies at a younger age, you feel like?
Yeah. I'm not sure they were good, but they were pretentious.
Critically acclaimed, at least.
Yeah, exactly.
You're about my age, right?
I'm 49.
Okay, a couple years older. I'm 46.
There you go.
So we're it's in the wheelhouse.
It's in the – and that is one of the shocking things to me is watching these movies as an older guy.
And like revisiting some of them?
Yeah. Yeah. And just how different it is. I mean, even like Ferris Bueller or Fast Times. I watched Fast Times recently.
I still love that movie.
It is a great movie.
Yeah.
But I was watching and I was like, Mr. Hand is talking about the Cuban Revolution.
Yeah.
And I'm like, tell me more. This sounds interesting. And then Jeff Spicoli pizza comes in and I'm like,
you just ruined the mojo.
Yeah. What are you doing, you dick?
That's so funny.
And I had the same reaction. I watched Ferris Bueller with my kids, and Ben Stein was talking about, like, trickle-down economics.
Yeah.
I'm like, I want to hear it. First of all, Ben Stein is crazy. You know, he's a crazy conservative.
Yeah.
You know? I want to hear his take on trickle-down economics. And
well, you know, the deal with that scene was that he – that was just him talking.
Really?
Yeah, because he wasn't an actor at the time. And John Hughes – and the only reason I know this is because I was supposed to record yesterday – with someone on Ferris Bueller. So I'd done my deep dive this week on that
Interesting.
Movie.
Interesting.
And John Hughes, I think, was a conservative too. So they were friends.
Really?
Yeah, which was sort of sad for me to learn, I guess. I don't know what I expected, but yeah. So anyway, he Ben Stein was talking to some crew members about that. And he overheard it, and he said, that's exactly what you need to do in this scene.
That is funny.
And it wasn't some deadpan shtick. It was just Ben Stein.
That is so – I had no idea.
Yeah.
Well, I do remember watching it with my – and when I was like the principal now, or it was the vice principal,
yeah.
whatever.
Jeffrey like, Jones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, he makes sense. Uh-huh. Like, I feel I've become so – I had the same reaction with Cat in the Hat. You know, the fish is the one who's like, what are you doing? Why? Like, you're letting this stranger into the house and he's like causing chaos and you're not going to tell your parents. I'm like, the fish is right. So yeah, I've become very old. I've decided.
Yeah. When you're identifying
movies.
Mr. Hand, then you know you've crossed to the, exactly. the other side. I reread Catcher in the Rye about every 5 or 6 years since I was probably 20. And it's just one of those books that I have done that on purpose because I had heard that, like, your perspective can switch on it over the years.
And did you find
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, I don't know if it's switched so much. I mean, definitely when you're younger, you know, there's a little bit of the Holden Caulfield in many of us.
Right.
With the phonies of the world. But sometimes it's reinforced as you get older.
Right,
And, you know.
I haven't read it in since I was Holden Caulfield's age. I would like to check that out. Yeah.
Or maybe just wait for the big movie.
Yeah. Did they ever make one?
No, I don't think so. I think that's sort of the unfilmable movie, right?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. They seem to film a lot.
So watching videos, were you also going out to the movie theaters, I guess, here in New York?
I was. I was a little. Yeah, I remember. Yeah, we would get high and go to the Pink Floyd's The Wall. That was a big memory.
Nice.
Very exciting.
Midnight movie or just?
No.
Just the regular showing.
Regular. I had a curfew, so I wasn't that much of a rebel. And also, I do remember seeing Richard Pryor's stand-up at the Ziegfeld. That was was amazing. I remember being blown away.
Saw it live or saw the movie?
No, I just saw the movie.
Oh, okay.
I saw the movie live.
Right. So what that would have been
was that?
Sunset Strip maybe? Live on the Sunset
Strip?
Yeah,
I think so.
Yeah. Boy, he was something else.
Yeah. So, I love the movies. And I remember when I was in college, I had a poster of A Clockwork Orange on my wall.
Really?
And it was worse than that, though. It was in Italian.
Like, oh.
I didn't see it in Italian. I don't speak Italian.
Yeah, but you were a New York kid.
But I went to some, like, village.
That's pretty cool.
Store. It was not cool. I think.
No, that's super cool.
Yeah?
Yeah.
All right.
I think so.
I always feel if I met myself as a teenager, I'd be like, what a dick.
Yeah, we're all little dicks, I think.
All right. That makes me feel better.
Before we dive into Clockwork Orange, though, I do want to bring up Groundhog Day because we went back and forth on email, and I felt bad because you had picked Groundhog Day originally, and just for the listeners out there, we had Griffin McElroy in of My Brother and Me, the podcast.
Right.
One of the three McElroy brothers. And he and I talked about that last week.
Mm.
And I told him that you had wanted it. And he kind of felt bad. But he said, but listen, man. He said, did he have a solid backup? And I said, oh, yeah, he had a pretty instant backup. He went, because I don't. And he said, not only is that my favorite movie, he said, of all time, but he said, I feel like it's the best movie of all time.
Well, I listen.
So he was hard in on that. But I do want to hear your thoughts
on
that.
Well, I appreciate his passion because I, too, love that movie. And I actually just watched it a couple months ago, and I was weeping. I was weeping at the ending scene when he's, like, helping all the people. So I've become a total sap.
Yeah.
It's quite embarrassing. But yeah, I loved that movie, and I saw the musical with my kids. They took me for Father's Day as like a special Father's
Day.
That's
right. I forgot it was a musical.
I really liked it. But I will say, at intermission, you know, one of the themes is that these people, these small town people, are like, they're wonderful. They're better than the big city people.
Yeah.
And but in intermission, I was like, wait a second, they're in Pennsylvania.
Right.
And I Googled it, and Punxsutawney went 78% for Trump.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that really hurt. Because then I spent the second half of, like, did the mayor vote for Trump?
Right.
Like, did the guys at the bar, who voted for Trump?
Uh-huh.
And I came up with, though, this made me feel better, like, if we could do a sequel, like Election Day, where it's like November 9th, and he has to convince all the people not to vote for Trump, or else he doesn't get to move on to the next day. That made me feel better. But I do love that movie, and
it's kind of a perfect little movie.
It is.
And rewatching it recently, because I'd seen it quite a few times, but with this show, I do, you know, sort of through the critical eye and take notes and really get in there. And it really, it is a great Bill Murray comedy. And if you just want to look at it that way, you've got plenty of that going on, but there's so much more happening in that film. And it could have been so cheesy and so spoon-fed, and Griffin and I were talking about that usually in a movie like that, there's some wise mentor who shows them the way, or just the main character will figure it out and discover it, but he fails so many times. He really doesn't get it until kind of like the last 10 or 15 minutes of the movie.
And he fails so spectacularly.
Yeah.
I love the different failures. The other thing that was exciting is I didn't know this, but I'm acquaintances with this guy whose brother was the one who came up with the idea. Danny Rubin.
Oh, really?
The guy.
And yeah, we talked about him.
On Facebook, I made some comment. I think I commented about the stage show. And Danny Rubin, who is a friend of a friend, commented that he said he thought I should do a book where I have to live the same day over and over again. And I'm like, well, this is the great moment in my life.
That's awesome. That's not a bad idea, but I don't know how you would do that just sort of set up and canned.
Right. Yeah. I would need an actual curse on my.
Well, and that was the other cool part about that movie, too, I thought, is that it didn't, it was never explained.
I love that. Yeah.
It just happened.
And the studio wanted it to.
They
wanted a genie or whatever. Uh-huh. But, that was remarkable. And, I agree. It is a perfect little movie. And it also, it becomes more meaningful for me because I think, as I mentioned before, I've become more and more sappy.
Uh-huh.
My teenage self would hate this guy, the guy I've become. He'd be like,
and you hate your teenage self.
Yeah,
isn't that funny?
We hate each other so much. We have so much self-loathing.
Yeah.
Because I do feel like my morals journey has uh-huh. similar, like, you know, I was an asshole,
right.
And now I'm slightly less of an asshole.
Hopefully. I have a hard time believing that.
the slightly less of an asshole?
No, the first part.
I think you're just
a great dude. I can't imagine
you
being
you're
a
very kind.
A
I'm not sure
jerk.
That's true.
All right, so let's get into Clockwork Orange. I just finished it this morning. I watched about 3/4 of it last night after my show, and then picked it up at 6:30 a.m.
That's tough to watch in the morning. I'm impressed.
Yeah, but and this is one I've obviously seen quite a few times, but it had been a while.
Yeah,
I realized
I haven't
I was
seen it,
it
in about 20 years. Is that right? 15, 20 years?
And did you watch it recently? Or?
I did watch it like a week ago for the show.
Oh, great. Thanks.
Of course. I will say this, that I think as a movie fan, you'll be horrified, as many of your listeners will be, but if you download it on YouTube, you can watch it in double speed.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I did watch it.
Did you really?
I know. Isn't that terrible?
No.
A little bit.
We have people that listen to Stuff You Should Know on double speed.
Well, I do that. Yeah.
Do you?
I'm a double speeder. But
yeah.
Something about the movies people find particularly offensive because it's supposed to be an emotional journey.
Right.
I mean, I have the emotions just more quickly.
Uh-huh.
And it was also interesting because there's that scene with the teenage girls.
Yeah, the sped up sex scene.
So yeah, that was very hard to follow.
That was lightning fast. So 1971, obviously the great Stanley Kubrick in doing his Kubrick thing to the fullest.
Oh yeah.
Which is wonderful. And Malcolm McDowell, Patrick McGee, Adrian Corey. Just so many great small roles in that movie from another one that just was killing me. And I found so much more of the comedy this time in it than I'd ever really noticed before.
Right.
The dark comedy. But the prison, the main prison guard guy.
Oh, he's wonderful.
Oh, yeah. Just fantastic.
And you know what I didn't know? I just looked up, like, you know, weird fun facts about A Clockwork Orange. Darth Vader. Did you see that?
Yeah, that was him, right? The bodyguard guy?
Yeah.
The manservant?
I didn't know. Yeah. The manservant
uh-huh.
who was with the very tight shorts
yes.
was Darth Vader, which I did not know. So that's a nice little Easter egg.
Well, first of all, I should mention when I lived in New York, like or New Jersey, 20 years ago, and we would come into New York all the time. My friends and I did for Halloween one year dress up as the Droogs.
How did it go? How was your codpiece?
It was pretty solid. You know, I mean,
what do you use for a cod? Do you have
I just
to buy?
Used a regular, just athletic jock strap.
Gotcha.
So it wasn't as authentic as like the real, you know, the one in the movie.
Right.
But we did okay. And, you know, put on the eyelash on one eye and had the hat and the cane. And It was weirdly, you kind of like, you know, we had a few drinks and we're walking around the city and you kind of fall into that. Obviously, we didn't do anything nefarious, but
right,
we were kind of like puffing our chest out a bit, you know?
That is interesting. Well, I find that always, like, the way you dress really does.
Because
I did a book on living by the rules of the Bible.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of them was you can only wear white clothes. So I was wearing white all the time, and it really did affect my mind.
Wow.
I was like, you know, I was feeling much more... I was like, I'm so spiritual. I'm wearing white, you know, either that or I'm like going to play Wimbledon or go to P. Diddy's party. But it definitely affects the outer, affects the inner.
Yeah.
So I would not want my kids to dress up as Alex.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How's the show going?
Which one?
The Living Benefit.
Oh, the
show.
I don't know. You've got several shows. It's good. I just went out there to see a taping last weekend.
I saw that on Facebook. Was that fun?
It was. I mean, very bizarre.
Yeah,
and, and I have no control over it, so that's a little bit terrifying.
Yeah, but you just sort of signed it away.
I signed it away.
Said, go with God.
go with God. Literally. And Les Moonves. That's right. I see it as like I gave them, here's a potato, and then they can make French fries or hash brown. Who knows what they're going to make. But it was fun. And I love the guy who's playing the character loosely based on me. He's very loosely
based. Jay Ferguson?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's terrific.
He's great. He was in Mad Men.
Yeah.
And he had a huge beard in Mad Men, and that's why I thought they cast him, because I had a beard in the book. But they're actually not letting him grow the beard until season two.
Okay. So that'll be the season two arc?
Yeah. That's the
well. That's nice to hear. There's a season two in the works already. That's great.
Oh no, I don't know if that's true, but they're saying if there was a season two.
I gotcha. So, first of all, the movie Clockwork Orange opens with just that red screen, and that you know, most of the score is the symphonic classical music of Beethoven. But there's also that Kubrickian Moog synthesizer.
It's unbelievable.
That is just so loud and powerful right from the beginning.
And it's funny, when I heard that for the first time in 15 years, it brought back, it was like my Madeline. It was like, wow, wow.
Yeah.
I was like, oh man, that puts me in.
And just so Kubrickian, you know, now that, when I saw it when I was in college, it was one of my first Kubrick movies probably I'd seen. But now that I've seen like most of the body of his work,
what else? Where else does he have that Moog synthesizer?
Well, I don't know if just that synthesizer, but just that sort of in your face, loud music, I think has sort of been a hallmark of his for sure.
Right.
Or maybe I'm just thinking of this.
Well, I do. You know, you have the Thus Spake Zarathustra or whatever it's called from 2001.
Yeah.
That's pretty memorable.
And this was, I think, just after that, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so. I only know that because I read some article there. Malcolm McDowell didn't know who Kubrick was.
And
someone's like, this, he did 2001.
Yeah.
Which actually I watched about 10 years ago, and that did not hold up as well.
Really?
For me. I found it a little slow. I should have watched it in double speed.
It is a little slow. Double speed might be just right for that one, which is probably heresy, you know, for most people.
I know.
But, 2001 is drags a bit.
I do, but I do think the Dr. Strangelove, that definitely holds up for me.
Yeah, I watch that every few years still.
Yeah, that's a
delight. One of my favorites. Well, and that's what made me kind of... I think I saw Strangelove even after I was all out of order with Kubrick, just as I discovered his movies over the years. So I saw Strangelove after Clockwork Orange. And so I didn't pick up on any of the dark comedy in Clockwork Orange. And then when I saw Strangelove, I sort of got his sense of humor a bit more.
Right, right.
And watching it last night and today, I was like, there were definitely a lot of times I was like, there's a lot of funny stuff going on.
A lot of
horrifying stuff too.
Right.
But he really just kind of walked that line.
Horrifyingly funny. And I will say, I remember my other strong memory of Kubrick was I got Barry Lyndon from that same video store. And I remember it also was a little slow, I found. But then the ending, they had this Chiron on the screen that I still think about all the time. And I don't remember the exact words, but it was basically... These events took place in the reign of King George III, and all the players, whether they were rich or poor or good or bad, they're all equal now. I was like, oh, man.
Wow.
So it was, but
they
I think
put a bow on that, didn't they?
Yeah. He's like, everybody died. Yeah. Pretty much the ending to any movie you could do, pretty much a Chiron, and then everyone died. But I do think about that a lot. You know, it was a very good, it was a memento mori. You know, we were all going to die.
Wow.
And last, Aubrey de Grey is right, and we can live forever.
So right.
He could
it's
be.
Either one of those two. Well, Kubrick definitely takes his time in all his movies, which I appreciate for sure, especially these days when I feel like the movies seem to be long, but they're not taking their time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's just scene after scene. Yeah. I will say, though, I was immediately hooked by A Clockwork Orange. I mean, that starts out strong. Him staring at you, the great voiceover, and that bar is quite startling.
Yeah, you know? The milk bar and just that long dolly back revealing everything.
And also just the milk coming from the woman's breast. It's like, and I mean, you know, the idea of milk, the most innocent. I think that's one thing he does very well was, you know, taking these very innocent things and making them really malevolent, like milk as a drug or singing in the rain.
Yeah.
I mean, he is good at ruining innocent stuff.
Yeah. Well, and even Alex as a whole, like part of the complexity of that character is that he's just like the nice boy next door. By all outward appearances, the way he converses with everyone and interacts.
Right.
It's usually very respectful. He doesn't, you know, that's part of the sinister thing is buried underneath, which makes it frightening. But he didn't make him just like a hooligan or a thug.
No, and the way he talks, it's so lovely and flower-like.
Yeah.
Even when he insults people, he's like, you eunuch jelly thou. Uh-huh. That just made me laugh, the way he talks. Clear as an azure sky in deepest summer.
Yeah.
Something like that.
So good. So the other thing that struck me was the just utter lack of backstory. Like the movie just starts in that milk bar and it just shows the Droogs doing their thing. And there's no sense of, and I guess that was part of the point. There's no sense of why he was like this to begin with.
Right.
And he was a true sociopath. The other guys were clearly sort of along for the ride.
Right.
But he was the one that was genuinely a sociopath, I think.
Well, what fascinated me is reading about it. I did not know about this final chapter that Anthony Burgess wrote that was cut out of the American version.
Oh, what is that?
In the final chapter, Alex grows up. He basically, he gets the Ludovico treatment out of his system and he goes back to raping and pillaging and then he gets bored and he's like, you know what? This is not. And then he sees one of his friends, I don't know, maybe one of the Droogs had a family and he's like, you know what? Maybe that would be better. And
really?
He becomes like this bourgeois, like nice, middle class working guy. And I think so that was Anthony Burgess's ending, and he was very nervous about the Kubrick version where Alex just continues to be this horrible sociopath.
Right.
So I thought that was fascinating. I did not, and I would actually, that would be an interesting sequel. Just Alex as like a middle class guy going around his business, like an incredibly dull movie.
Right.
but that was, I think that when I read that, that definitely changed it for me because that appeals to the old me, the me now.
Right.
Like, oh, okay, he finally, like, he got some morality. Whereas the version where he stays the sociopath appealed to my teenage self. He's like, yeah.
Right.
You know, the system's terrible.
Right.
I'm glad that he's back to being horrible.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because now that I know that that chapter exists, maybe he is not a sociopath. Was he just a bored, disaffected youth?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, he certainly does seem like a sociopath. I mean, the joy that he seems to derive from ultra-violence. Because it's not just he's doing it to get something. Like, he actually enjoys the violence.
Yeah.
But maybe you outgrow it. I mean, I think that is a nice thought. I don't know if it's true that people change. I hope it's true. I think I've changed. I've become, as I say, I do think I'm less of an asshole. So, Yeah, I hope that that's true.
Well, I really like the part sort of early on in that first act when the other fellas try to challenge his power.
Oh, yeah.
And it obviously none of that works out, and he reestablishes himself in sort of a comically brutal way when you look at the scene now. Although it was in slow motion, you saw it at double speed, walking by the riverbank. But that's when I really solidified. I was like, no, this guy's really crazy.
And right.
His friends they're the bored ones.
Right, right, right.
They're just following along, basically.
Especially Dim. I mean, he's obviously.
Yeah, he's challenged.
Not so sharp. But yeah, well, it is, I have to say, slow motion violence. I guess that must have been an early version of it. Like now, I guess it's probably cliched, but then. It did look lovely.
Yeah.
Like the way he splashes into the river after he's hit. There is something. I am a sucker for slow motion violence with classical music in the background.
Yeah,
I think
it really does go together, doesn't it? Your kind of movie then.
Yeah.
The prison check-in scene is one of my favorite scenes and that's just a perfect example of Kubrick just taking his time. Like that could have been a throwaway scene, or it could have been 8 seconds long.
Right.
And he just lets it go on and on. And I just, like, found myself laughing out loud.
And it was the guard was saying all of his personal effects. Uh-huh. And like, yeah, he's like, yeah, you have a comb. And yeah, that was funny.
One piece of chocolate. Yeah. And, you know, he makes him stand behind the line. It just goes on and on and on. But I always get the sense that Kubrick just, I guess some people have called him self-indulgent. But I don't really see it that way. I think he's definitely kind of fucking with people.
Right.
For his own amusement sometimes. And maybe that is total self-indulgence.
Maybe he's got a little Alex in him. He's like
maybe.
A little sadistic. He's like, you're going to watch this. And like the Ludovico technique, the fact that he like made us watch that for so long.
Yeah, yeah. That was not a quick thing either.
Yeah. That's interesting. I wonder. I mean, I will say that watching Eyes Wide Shut, I felt like he was torturing me.
You didn't like it?
Did not like
it. Very divisive movie.
I haven't seen it since it came out.
So no, I get it, man. Very divisive movie. A lot of people hate that fucking movie.
What do you like about it? I'm interested.
I think I was just so in on Kubrick that I'm just all in. So I love the pace. I love how slow it was and how it revealed itself. Yeah, man, I just loved it. And hearing the backstory behind it, I think it sort of...
I don't know the backstory.
Well, just how long it
took.
It was just years and years. And put that couple, the real-life couple at the time, with Cruise and Kidman, through hell to do 70, 80, 100 takes. And it's the madness of it is just striking to me as a filmmaker. And this was the quickest movie he's ever made, apparently.
This one, A Clockwork Orange?
Yeah, I think... Yeah. It took a year to get into theaters, which for Kubrick was just
right, that's
like
lightning
a rapid pace.
That's funny. Well, no, Eyes Wide Shut, it ruined orgies for me forever. I am never going to go to an orgy.
No more?
It just looks so boring.
Yeah.
And the masks, so silly.
It was very silly, but I was all in. And it was just such a beautiful looking movie, too.
It did, yes, it did
look
beautiful.
Like his aesthetic has just always blown me away.
It also, I mean, I still do, this is in retrospect that I have issues with Tom Cruise.
Sure.
But
because of the, you know,
the whole
Scientology.
Like, yeah.
it's hard to separate the art from the artist in that case.
Oh, it is. Yeah, I think about that a lot more and more. Like, how do you separate the art from the artist?
I know.
Because it's tough.
It is.
This was shocking to me. I did some research and I read that the book, which I had read back in high school, but I had forgotten, in the book, Alex is even worse than he is in the movie.
Oh, really?
He do you remember the scene with the two girls? They go to the music store, and then he brings them home. Those the fast-forward sex scene.
Yeah.
In the book, they were 10 years old.
Oh, my God.
I know. It's unbelievable.
Seriously?
Yeah.
And in the movie, he's younger. Obviously, 10 is a crime no matter what.
Right.
But I think in the movie, he's 17, and in the book, he's more like 15.
Oh, really?
But still, that's horrifying.
It was horrifying.
And he doesn't seem 17 in the movie either. I know he was older when he played him, but I don't, in fact, until I researched it, I didn't know that he was supposed to be that young.
Yeah, I always saw him as like 2021.
Yeah, same here.
That's interesting. Yeah, it was.
But there's a part about him not going to school.
That's true.
That I never just sort of picked up on.
Yeah.
Because it just seems
maybe
like they're always
college,
roaming around.
It's like getting his PhD.
Whatever they call high school in England. So obviously the movie was maligned by many critics and the Catholic Church for sure. And it's certainly horrifying, all the violence and the sex at a time when I think, you know, putting those two things together on screen was a maverick move for sure.
Right.
But, Kubrick just, I forgot about the part where he full on goes Roman soldier torturing Christ in that one scene.
Oh, he has the Ludovico treatment?
Yeah, he has the fantasy, and it shows Jesus, Jesus being whipped, and then it pans, it, you know, pulls back and reveals that he's the Roman soldier.
That and, was very,
yeah, so I was like, very, well, of course the Catholic Church, like, you can't show that.
And then the other thing was when he was fantasizing, he's reading the Bible, and he's loving the parts,
yeah,
which are about, like, the sex and the, you know, eating the grapes and having the orgies. Which was funny to me because I spent a year and a half really studying the Bible.
Right.
And there's all the, especially the Old Testament.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there is some serious craziness and perversion.
Yeah.
So I can see how someone from his mindset.
Yeah.
I mean, there are scenes like where Lot escapes, you know, Lot's wife is turned into a pillar of salt.
Uh-huh.
He escapes with his daughters. His daughters think they're the last people on earth and get him drunk and sleep with him.
So, right.
And I was like, my God, I don't want my kids reading this. So,
yeah.
But yeah, that was remarkable. It is no wonder. I mean, it made me think a lot about the deeper moral messages, and this idea, because I am very torn, and I don't expect you or anyone to agree with me.
Okay.
But, I don't really believe in free will. I think, you know, we are basically meat robots.
Uh-huh.
We feel compassion. I'm all for that. But to me, like, I'm torn on the Ludovico technique. Like, if you could do this Pavlov technique, mm-hmm. and reform criminals, would that be okay? And part of me is like, you know what? Depriving him of the so-called choice, the delusion of choice not to rape someone, that doesn't bother me that much.
Uh-huh.
You know, like if I could have a society where really horrible sociopaths did feel physically ill,
uh-huh.
if they were about to rape someone, I may be okay with that.
I think a lot of people would agree with you.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What about this one? I don't know. This one I think I'm out on in a very small minority. The Minority Report.
The movie?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Like from a utilitarian point.
Precogs?
Yeah. Having three people
uh-huh.
have pretty terrible life to make the rest of the world happy and safe.
Like, right.
Is it worth, like, if the precogs were truly good people, they'd be like, you know what? I'm going to do it.
Uh-huh.
I hate it. It's horrible.
Yeah.
But I'm going to do it to save other people.
Right.
So,
well, that's the trolley problem, right?
Yeah, exactly. It
uh-huh.
is the trolley problem. And I am one of the people who would pull the lever.
Yeah.
And I know I'm in the I think it's 10% of people
uh-huh,
who pull the
so.
Lever.
Yeah.
And I am one of those. And it was very disturbing. I was just looking it up. I saw a study recently that people who would pull the lever
mm-hmm.
have a high degree of, like, sociopathy and
yeah
they're horrible people, but I hope I'm not horrible, but I still would pull the lever.
No, I don't think that makes you horrible at all. It just makes you one of the 10%.
the freakish 10%.
Well, with Alex though, Kubrick, especially in that third act, he really just goes total sort of mind fuck on the audience to where he is eliciting sympathy now.
Oh, yeah.
Because this monster is now a pawn of the government and a lab rat, essentially.
Right.
And he's clearly making a statement there.
Oh, yeah. And the way that he portrayed the liberal guy, you know, the guy who takes him in, who is the victim of the initial crime, he portrays him as a psycho as well. So no one comes off very well.
Right.
Like, neither side. It was – and what's interesting, I think as a teenager, I definitely – I liked that part because I could like – empathize with the rebel Alex, like poor Alex being screwed by society. Now the character I empathize with most is the old homeless guy who gets beat up.
Right.
Like.
But he gets his revenge too.
Yeah, I know. It's like I was rooting for him when he was beating up Alex.
Yeah, the old people like attack him in the end.
I'm like, good for old people.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is funny. It is a very anti old people. It is, old people are terrible.
Yeah, and I'm not even sure what Kubrick's, and I don't know, he probably wanted it that way, to not have a very sort of clear-cut black-and-white statement on this stuff.
Right.
I think he wanted to leave it very murky and leave people scratching their heads and contemplating this when they left the theater,
And it worked. I mean, I'm sure he was slightly on the side of freedom of choice that this is an authoritarian way to engineer people to, make them feel sick. But he did a very good job of showing both sides and making fun of the liberal side.
Yeah.
I mean, that scene where they're feeding Alex dinner and, it's the reformers feeding Alex dinner.
Yeah.
And he's like, more wine.
Yeah.
That made me laugh very hard watching it this time.
Yeah. Oh, man, Malcolm McDowell is so good in this movie.
He is. And like the innocence he has in that scene where he's
Yeah.
Oh, and you know what else makes me laugh? That Malcolm, like the joy, the innocent joy he gets at the end where they're showing him the cartoons and he has to come up. With and just the laughter he gets from like, I want it, no time for the check the meter, just time for the in out, whatever it was. And his laughter in that is, he's a remarkable actor.
Yeah. And it just shows like he is sort of a kid in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the way his parents treat him, his weird mom with the purple hair, it's almost like that, it's almost like his parents were drugged. And it was all just, I don't know. It just killed me to see that his family had no idea what he was doing. And he was laying in bed and she was trying to get him to go to school. And he's like, no, Ma, just need to get myself right. And, she leaves him alone.
Well, it terrified me. Yeah. Because, I mean, I was not a particularly bad kid, but I remember I definitely snuck out. I had my curfew at midnight. I would come in, say goodnight to my parents. And then I would go out. I would take the elevator. I would go down the stairs to the one floor below and take the elevator there because I was worried the sound of the elevator would wake my parents up.
Oh, nice.
So, I am. My kids are getting to be teenagers now, and I'm just terrified of what they are going to do that I don't know about.
Yeah.
I guess it's good now that, you can basically – it is a this dystopian future where you can track everyone all the time.
Right.
So I suppose I can probably figure out where they are at any time, which is good and bad.
So there's a few bits of trivia here. Let me see if these are interesting. Oh, here's one I thought was very Kubrickian. He, and you may know some of these, but he apparently had his assistant destroy all the footage that he didn't use.
Really?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
That's too bad.
It just seems like a very Stanley Kubrick thing.
And I'm sure they were
a control freak.
There were 80 takes of each one.
Yeah, exactly. So, basically no one's ever going to change this movie or use any of this for anything.
Well, another thing I read that I didn't know is that Kubrick got death threats in England.
Oh, really?
After the movie came out and saying that they were going to do a home invasion of Kubrick.
Oh.
And he refused to let it be shown in England after that until after he died. So
really?
It was never screened in England.
Wow.
Well, I think really that was certainly, it was on the internet.
Uh-huh. But, so it has to be true. he also was so worried that, that theater owners themselves would cut parts of it out.
Oh, really?
That he apparently had, had new prints shipped every week and swapped them out for the current print.
Wow.
Which is,
that's amazing.
Yeah, that's a level of control that even is shocking to me. Here's one. Gene Kelly met Malcolm McDowell years later at a party and walked away in disgust.
Really?
Yeah, and he was not happy about the Singing in the Rain bit.
Oh, Gene. Oh, yeah. I was thinking in my mind Gene Hackman. Hackman dislike him so much? Gene Kelly, yeah. Well, it's shocking to me that they got the rights to that. How do they get the rights to that? Or are they allowed to use this?
Well, the story I read was that he said, you know, can you do a little dance or something? And the only song that Malcolm McDowell could remember was Singing in the Rain. And so Kubrick loved it. And it said, quickly secure the rights for $10,000 the next day. And clearly Gene Kelly didn't have anything to do with it.
Right.
Or it wasn't clearly, you know, stated like how it was going to be used. One or the other. But they got the rights and Gene Kelly was not psyched
about it. I did get to meet Malcolm McDowell.
Oh, wow.
When I was a reporter at Entertainment Weekly.
Uh-huh.
And they were doing a reboot of Fantasy Island. And he was Mr. Rourke.
He'd be kind of perfect at that role.
He was a great Mr. Rourke. The show did not... Actually, I liked the show. It was Barry Sonnenfeld who was a director, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. That's a good pedigree.
I did interview and I did like do my fawning, like, I love Clockwork Orange.
Sure.
He was very polite. Like,
yeah.
He didn't scoff or anything. He was like, thank you.
Well, he didn't, I think that he and Kubrick didn't speak for quite a while after, and that really disappointed him. And I think Kubrick has a track record of not staying friends. Like he and Peter Sellers didn't speak again.
Really?
During their lifetime, I think. But he was.
He just cuts them off.
I think so. I don't know if it's a rule or it's just happened a lot. But, you know, he was always accused of sort of treating the talent like cattle.
Right.
And not really caring or seemingly caring much for the actors and their well-being and their welfare by grinding them through these processes.
Right.
But Malcolm McDowell was friends with Mrs. Kubrick, and they kept in touch. And I think it said years later, after his passing, he went with her to his grave and, like, really kind of broke down.
Aww.
It's pretty interesting.
That's nice.
Because he was young, you know, when they made it. I mean, I know he wasn't 17, but
right.
I think he was 22 or 23.
That is it.
And that was his first big, big thing.
Right.
He had been in other movies.
He had been in If, which I remember
right.
seeing as well. Well, it's interesting. I mean, that brings up the whole issue to me of, like, is it okay for a director to be cruel and sadistic if it gets this amazing performance out of them?
Like, I know.
What are the ethics of that?
I know.
Because there's, like, Hitchcock. That guy was a terrible
yeah.
human being
I
to
know.
His actors and actresses. And
that's yeah, a tricky one.
It is a tricky one.
Yeah.
I remember reading when I took a film class at senior year in high school, and I remember reading about Public Enemy, the original with Jimmy Cagney,
uh-huh.
and how there's a famous scene where he takes a grapefruit at breakfast and then and just shoves it in his girlfriend's face
uh-huh.
and mashes it, and they didn't tell her that this was going to happen because
yeah.
they wanted to see
the real
reaction. So yeah, I would say it's
That's
probably
a tough call.
Not. Probably not a good idea, but it is interesting because you do get a different reaction. I'm sure a much more
oh,
real
yeah,
reaction.
Sure. All right. So we wrap up here on Movie Crush with a couple of quick segments. One is called What Ebert Said.
This movie is a complete disappointment.
How do you like it?
He didn't.
Interesting.
And this is one of those, and he's done a few movies where he had gone back later and said, hey, I admit I was wrong.
Right.
I didn't get it. It's clearly a classic. But he stuck to his guns on this one, did not like it. He gave it 2 stars, and he says this. And this, I think, kind of summarizes a lot of critics' issues with it in general, because I read a bunch of reviews. Stanley Kubrick's Clockwork Orange is an ideological mess, a paranoid right-wing fantasy masquerading as an Orwellian warning. It pretends to oppose the police state and force mind control, but all it really does is celebrate the nastiness of its hero, Alex. Alex is violent because it is necessary for him to be violent in order for this movie to entertain in the way Kubrick intends. He has been made into a sadistic rapist, not by society, not by his parents, not by the police state or the centralization, and not by creeping fascism, but by the producer, director, and writer of this film.
It's a real ad hominem attack.
I know. He goes on to explain that he does know it is a book that it was based on, but he really lays it all at the feet of Stanley Kubrick.
That is it. Well, it is, you know, the whole idea of like glorification of violence, even when you're pretending to be
making a statement about it. Yeah.
And just in general, like Oliver Stone's Wall Street, I'm sure, inspired thousands of kids to go into Wall Street and be like, greed is good. So even if you do have the intention, which I think Kubrick hopefully had.
Yeah, and Stone, of course.
Yeah.
And then finally, we finish with five questions. And these can be as succinct as you want, or you can elaborate. The first movie you remember seeing in a theater.
I remember seeing it was some Charlie Brown movie, and I was terrified. My parents had to take me out because it was like they were too big. Uh-huh. I was like, what are these giants moving around on the screen?
Yeah.
So I've since I can now see movies in the theater. I'm not too scared.
Do you remember the first R-rated movie you ever saw?
I do. It was Blazing Saddles. It was for my friends. We must have been like 11. I don't know. And his babysitter took us all for a birthday to a double feature of Bananas and Blazing Saddles. And my mother was horrified. She's like, they took you to an R-rated movie. That is absolutely inappropriate.
Speaking of movies that could never be made today.
Oh, yeah.
Certainly Blazing Saddles.
Right. Absolutely.
It's funny because I saw that. I don't count that as my first R-rated movie because I was too young to really get it. But I did go to the drive-in for a double feature, and Blazing Saddles was one of those movies. But I was 5 or 6. And I just remember the horse punching scene. That's literally the only thing that stands out in my mind as a child.
And were you horrified or you liked it?
No, I think I was asleep in the seat and woke up and like saw that part and then went back to sleep. So I don't count it as my first R-rated
movie. I mean, the fart scene appealed.
Oh, sure, for a kid that age.
Right.
Well, and my age too, let's be honest. will you walk out of a bad movie? And do you remember doing that? Recently,
I have done. My wife refuses to. She's like, once you pay, you're in. Uh-huh. Which I think is, you know, I think it's a logical fallacy. It's like the sunken cost. I think there's an even name for it.
Uh-huh.
But I will walk out. I'm trying to think what was the last one. I mean, I very rarely see movies in the theater anymore.
Right.
So
I think a lot of us are in that boat.
It's much easier to pause. And a lot of times you'll pause and you're like, I'll get back to that tomorrow.
And then it doesn't happen.
Yeah. So that's sort of the modern equivalent of walking out.
Yeah, exactly. Do you have a guilty pleasure that you kind of go back to
that you can think question. Of? Well, is watching Woody Allen's and movies and feeling guilty, does that count?
Maybe.
I do love
usually
Annie
a guilty
Hall.
Pleasure is like a not so great movie. Right. But yeah, I know what you mean. It's tough with Woody these days.
I could have chosen for this. It was between Groundhog's Day, A Clockwork Orange, and an Albert Brooks movie. I mean,
just any of them.
Any Real Life was one of the greatest movies
Modern
of all
romance.
Time.
Great.
Modern Romance. So let me think. What are some other guilty pleasures? Well, you know what? I feel very guilty about this. They did. I used to work at Entertainment Weekly.
Uh-huh.
And they were doing a guilty pleasures issue.
Oh, wow.
And so everyone had to pitch, and I pitched the Ernest movies, like Ernest Goes to Jail.
Yeah, even that would qualify.
Well, but here's the thing. I had never actually seen one. I just thought the idea was funny.
Uh-huh.
So I pitched it, and they're like, yeah, I wish I got it. So then I had to watch the Ernest Goes to Jail movies. I'm like, these are terrible.
They're not even pleasures.
They're not even so bad they're good.
Yeah.
They're just so bad they're bad.
I never saw any of those.
So if anyone reads that essay I wrote about Ernest, I apologize. That is a misrepresentation. That is terrible journalism.
And finally, question 5, we end with movie going 101. I know you don't get to the theater much anymore, but what are your movie rituals when you were going to the movies? Were there certain theaters or a certain seat or concessions that you would always get?
I do the aisle seat. It's interesting because when my wife and I would go, when we first started dating, I remember like holding hands during Shakespeare in Love was like one of the great moments of my life.
Oh,
like,
that's sweet.
One of the first times I held her hand. Now she likes to have a seat in between us. So that's sort
very
of the,
symbolic.
The evolution of our marriage.
Yeah, man. That's
She's
how
like,
it works.
I don't need to sit next to you. I don't want to talk to you. During, yep. And if you check your iPhone, that's going to drive me crazy. So uh-huh.
She'll call the usher out on you, on her own husband.
Exactly. So, yeah, I guess that's my ritual is sitting a seat away from my wife.
Uh-huh.
But I do, you know. I do love the movies, yeah. I gotta say. And it's interesting to see how long this will last as a, you know, how is it? Because it has lasted mm-hmm. a long time, the idea of like an hour and a half, 2 hour
yeah.
movie where you just sit there and watch. But, like, you know, are my grandkids going to be like, well, right. what were you thinking? Like, you didn't get to shoot anyone.
Right.
You weren't in the scene. Uh-huh. You weren't like interacting with the actors. You were yeah. just watching.
Very interesting.
And also, you know what, I feel lucky that we were in the era of the movie sets where they have these mm-hmm. enormous, because I imagine in like 50 years, CGI will be so good.
It's all recreated.
Yeah. Like, yeah. why would you spend $1 million to recreate New York when you can have this amazing, you know, New yeah. York perfectly? So I love the fact that we still live in the era of these crazy sets that yeah. are made up.
Good stuff, man.
I loved it. Thank you. I could talk all day about this.
All right. Thanks a lot, bud.
Thanks, Chuck.
All right. So another one in the can here in New York City. That was A.J. Jacobs. Really great guy. And it was kind of fun to talk to a native New Yorker about his experience growing up in the city and kind of how he spent his time and his movie watching time. Very, very good guy, and really loved hearing his insight, not only on A Clockwork Orange, but what he had to say about Groundhog Day, which is pretty cool. So thanks to AJ. If you want to read his books, there are many worse ways to spend your time, let me tell you. Check out The Year of Living Biblically is one. The Know-It-All is another great book. Drop Dead Healthy is another book. The Guinea Pig Diaries. They are all really terrific. And his brand new book, with Simon and Schuster, called It's All Relative, Adventures Up and Down the World's Family Tree. This one is excellent. He sent me an advanced copy, and I've already read it, and it's really, really wonderful. It sort of just tackles the notion that we are all related in this world, and he does a deep dive on that, and it's really terrific. So thanks to AJ, thanks to you all, and we will see you next week on Movie Crush. And until next time, I am going to be cleaning some disgusting stuff off the bottom of my shoe. Movie theaters are gross.